I think we'll begin. Others will come in as the next few minutes come along. My name is Bob Correll. I've been honored to ask to chair and facilitate this panel. And we have before us four individuals whose historic experience and participation in this summit enables them to really begin to synthesize, put together some of the central messages that both their experience and their participation in this symposium allow. During these 3 days, you've seen many, many perspectives, like a magnificent diamond through which we can see many facets of what brings the Antarctic Treaty to such a momentous moment of 50 years of implementation. And for some of us who come from the science community, what the treaty did was facilitate some just absolutely stunning scientific work and discoveries, everything from how some species survive in such hostile environments to how volcanoes work, to better understanding how this unique place allows us to better understand how the planet's climate and related systems, but also to use it as a base for understanding things that go beyond our planet through astronomy. And as many of you know, the first neutrino detector was turned on, and that will give us some insights that are probably unattainable anywhere else on the planet. So it is a unique place from a scientific perspective. And during the last panel and others like it, we saw how the legal frameworks really explicitly help countries, states, behave in the context of a place that they all jointly have responsibility for. Our task this afternoon is to try to share the perspective from these four individuals, the kind of thing we've heard and how it fits into their experience, because every one of them has a long history of both polar and particular Antarctic experience, and try to synthesize some of the things that I will call kind of key understandings or key findings that this symposium has allowed us to pause after 50 years and to observe and try to understand. we'll have about 5 to 8 minutes or so from each of the panelists to share some of their thoughts with you. And then, assuming we have some time, there'll be opportunities for comments. There may be a question or two, but I'd like to urge those of you who wish to speak, speak in the context of what you've learned, one of the things that you've observed as being a part of this summit. Our first panelist is Jim Barnes, as many of you know, is a professor at many universities over his many years. He's worked at many institutions, but most importantly, he is the executive director and co-founder of Antarctica and the Southern Ocean Coalition. Many, many years of interest in, leadership about, and understanding of how Antarctica fits in to the global environment and to the way countries and peoples behave therein. Jim has some observations to share with us, and I'll turn the meeting over to him. And if you want to do it from the podium, you may, or from there, whichever.
I hope this is helpful. What I've done as we had this really wonderful conversation the last 3 days is to write down some of what I thought were key points and also to show some resonance between what ASOC has been doing recently. We've been doing some surveys. I'm going to tell you a little bit about it because I think there's a lot of overlap and resonance between, synergy to use that word, between what we've done here and what ASOC has been doing this last year. In our surveys, we're asking people, imagine what Antarctica will be like in 50 years. What do you want to see Antarctica be like in 50 years? What don't you want to see Antarctica be like in 50 years? And that's the framework in which we have been doing these surveys. And as just an aside, some of you may have seen the wilderness poster we had at the reception last night as part of the poster show. That's a poster about wilderness values and We've got some strips of paper out there on the table for people to fill out if they want to go online and do a questionnaire. That's one of the surveys we have going. So in our surveys, we are getting a lot of information that, as I said, I think resonates with what we've done here. We find very, very strong support for using Antarctica in perpetuity to carry out globally significant science, for which is either the only or the best platform, and maintaining the open science regime. And I think that's one of the most important values of the Antarctic Treaty to be projected into the future, as well as a gift we can give to the whole planet. We're finding very, very strong support for the idea that we want to try to keep Antarctica as pristine as possible to maintain the so-called wilderness and aesthetic values. And as an aside, a resolution on this was just passed a few weeks ago at the World Wilderness Congress in, or the World Parks Congress, one of the two, in Mexico, and that's on our website. We find no support so far, but we've asked treaty parties, we've asked scientists, we've asked the public in general, what do you think about tourism? And we find no support for Antarctica becoming what I'll call a mass tourist destination with huge numbers, infrastructure on land, the large vessels carrying thousands of passengers and so forth. And we see that there's increasing support, especially in the ATTS, which knows its own situation so well, for minimizing the human footprint of all of our activities by sharing logistics and infrastructure and avoiding duplication and so forth. So that's what we're deriving from our surveys. And drawing out of the process we've just been through now the last 3 years, it seems like I broke these into two parts, process-related ideas and what I'll call substantive-related ideas. I think we all know this. Bringing all of our measures and our annexes and so forth into force promptly is really important for the functionality of the system, for the credibility and legitimacy of the system. And it has practical implications, and I just picked out one, the liability annex, which has enormous implications for what happens if there's an accident involving a ship, for example. And yet so far, after 10 years of negotiation and many years since we assigned it, I think 5 or 6, I think only 4 countries have ratified it yet. So it's not in force, and that's not good. The information exchange system that lies at the heart of our obligations is in some disarray, it would appear, with many parties, as we heard, not complying with that fundamental thing. I think we need to roll up our sleeves and think, what are we going to do much better on that? The inspection regimes, while they're not mandatory, I see those as very, very important to the ongoing legitimacy of the system. And also to learn what are the best, I'm focusing more on the environmental side now, the checklists and so forth. What is best practice? How can we promote best practice? How can we achieve the highest standards and so forth? I was really intrigued by this idea of moving the SCAR and COMNEP offices into the Buenos Aires Secretariat as a way to promote synergies and so forth. Now, I know that that would kick up a lot of fuss for the people that have to move, but we need to prod ourselves a little bit and think of creative ways to make our system work better. So that's one that struck me. There were many people making observations about promoting positive synergies among the various agreements with pertinence and or competence in the Southern Ocean. There's a lot of them. But how do we do it? We haven't really, I think, come to grips with that very well in this meeting, and that may be one of the future work items we could talk about. And then the idea of giving the ATCM some form of continuing personality rather than just having a two-week life or using standing committees. I think there's probably a lot of food for thought there. Again, we're not going to reach any conclusions here about that. And I know it's controversial for some. But it is awkward that it kind of ends every year after the meeting, as Jan was saying. On transparency, we heard some about this, and I just wanted to share some of our experiences on that regard, because I look at it on two levels. One is, how do you tell your message to the public, and particularly through the media? Well, in all the years I've been going to Antarctic Treaty meetings, the only one where we had a really proactive approach, and I salute them for this, was the UK in Edinburgh. And I think everybody found that it worked really well. We got lots of public involvement, school children with the websites that BAS set up and the journalists and so forth. But because it's always up to each individual
party who's the host, we haven't continued that. I think we should try to learn from that experience. How about documentation? Documents from the ATCMs at least are public after the ATCMs. That's a big improvement from the past. But why not make them available before the meeting so the public and the press can see what we're doing? What are we hiding, in short? And then the Camelot story is a little more difficult. There, we basically don't make the real Camelot documents except for the final report public. And I had an interesting experience recently. I was trying to find some of my own ASOC documents from the past, and I learned that I couldn't even access the system because only states can access the archive of Camelot after a meeting is over. So that was a surprise for me. On substance, some of the main things that have come out, again, both through our surveys and through this last 3 days, we need to finally bite the bullet on commercial tourism and decide what kind of regulatory arrangement we want to develop so that we can avoid what I'll call mass tourism, the use of the larger, riskier vessels, to have a ban on land-based tourism. Everybody seems to want these things, but we haven't figured out the modalities to do it. One of the most exciting things going on right now is the IMO's development of a legally binding and mandatory polar code. That's starting in February at the IMO. It has strong support by the treaty parties, but it's going to take a lot of work to make that a good code. It'll probably take, I think, at least 3 years. But that's a major synergy opportunity, and because of the overlapping competence and jurisdiction of the two treaties, we've got to work together in that way. The idea of having the large marine protected areas reserves has come up, and that's, again, a major initiative of the civil society groups. We were very pleased to see that Camelot and ACCPs have endorsed the idea of a target of 2012 for the first phase of this system, focusing on the 11 areas so far identified, and we had a good success this last year, as you heard. I mean, this year, as you heard, the South Orkneys. I would say this, if Camelot and the ATCM can deliver on that by 2012, the kudos that will be earned will be very, very high, and it will have very practical and positive implications on all kinds of levels. We didn't talk much about illegal fishing, but I have to say, we think, the ASOC groups think, this is one of the black marks. It's not strictly speaking against the system because it's beyond your control in many respects, and yet it's happening in the area for which you have claimed responsibility and promised to take actions. It's huge. It's expensive. It's like drugs almost. You know, it's out of control, very big numbers. And we could do a lot better on this. And if we did, again, we would earn a lot of plaudits from the larger public. We would see albatrosses and petrels stopping. They wouldn't be killed in such large numbers and so forth. So I think that's a major challenge to roll up our sleeves on that. This is one we didn't talk about at all, but it's one I've spent the last 3 years working on. I just wanted to showcase it for you a bit. The base of the food chain, as we heard, is krill. We've been working for 3 years in Camelot to develop a small-scale management unit ecosystem-based approach. It's a very slow, complicated process, and I think it's one of the major outputs that we could look forward to seeing. And again, if we can succeed on that, we'll have a good news story for ourselves, and we'll have a good news story for other RFMOs. And we talked about the bioprospecting. There's a lot to be done there. The good news is we actually have a working group going on. The less good news is I don't think we know where we're going to go with it yet. There's not real congruence of opinion, so we have a lot more talking to do there. And then last, I just wanted to show you again, this is a poster I had up. I know you can't see it because it's too fuzzy, but we're producing a series of posters that try to capture what's going on in Antarctica. That's a public education piece. We have one that shows the maze of transportation corridors on land and air as an overlay to this, but I'm not going to try to show you that right now. Thank you very much. And I just want to thank Paul and the organizers for a wonderful conference.
Thanks, Jim. Our next speaker is Chris Joyner, who, as many of you know, is at Georgetown, but he's been around the town when it comes to universities, from East Coast to West Coast, even a part of the Institute in Australia. But as you know, he's been recognized around the world for his work on this business, and he brings a real spectrum of scholarship insight to this discussion. And Chris, it's all yours.
Thank you very much, Bob, for those kind words. I appreciate it. And to echo Jim, I want to thank Paul Berkman and the advisory board of the summit and the other organizers for putting together what has really been a truly memorable conference and a very important gathering. And I say that with a confession that I am not a lawyer, I am not a diplomat, I am not a politician, and I'm not a scientist. I am, in the words of Orrin Young, a political scientist, as he is, but I prefer to consider myself an international relations specialist who, like all of you, has a core interest in the law and politics affecting the South Pole region. I would like to pick up on a theme that permeated much of this discussion, but without any real focus. That theme is the challenges which confront the Antarctic Treaty today and in the foreseeable future. Denzel Miller mentioned that we're in a world of globalization, and I think that's perfectly true. I also think that it's these processes of globalization that contribute to making these challenges inherently difficult and issues that will need to be addressed by the consultative parties in the near term. There are three challenges which have been mentioned throughout this meeting. I just want to put them in context throughout some questions that I hope substantively contribute to understanding these issues, but more importantly, invite some thought about their resolution. The first are the challenges from sovereignty and natural resources, and these have taken the form most recently in the submission to the United Nations Commission on the Limits to the Continental Shelf, the submissions by the claimant states. And just to show you how fast these have come about, well, let me back up a second. The claimant states have also made claims to territorial waters off their claims. Australia, New Zealand, France, the United Kingdom, Argentina, and Chile have all proclaimed territorial seas off their sectors. Contiguous zones have been proclaimed by Australia, New Zealand, France, Argentina, and Chile. EEZs have been proclaimed by Australia, Argentina, France, and Chile. But the issue which has come before this conference most preeminently are the claims to the continental shelf areas beyond 200 nautical miles. Again, these have been recently submitted to the United Nations Law of the Sea Commission on the limits of the continental shelf. Full submissions were submitted by Australia in 2004, Norway 2009, Argentina 2009. Partial submissions were made by New Zealand 2006, Norway 2006, France 2009, and the United Kingdom in 2008 and 2009. Chile declared its jurisdiction over the continental shelf in an area that it has designated the Presidential Sea and provided, quote, preliminary information to the Commission in 2009. So these have all been interpreted as warning signals that claims have either been enlarged or they're being extended or that some new claims are being made by the claimant states, and this has provoked a lot of concern amongst lawyers, diplomats, and people interested in the Antarctic Treaty system. There are lots of questions I thought of that pertain to this issue which should be addressed, I think, and I just touched on some of those. Do these submissions invite the suggestion that these are new claims, or might they be considered extensions of the claims already in place? Or if they're merely existent claims that already exist, does the status change if the claimant states act on national legislation to implement these claims? Fortunately, that hasn't happened yet, and I think that is going to be a key determinant with respect to the stability of these claims. I might add that the Antarctic Treaty consultative parties recognized the importance of this issue in the ministerial declaration on the 50th anniversary of the Antarctic Treaty in April of 2009, which launched the beginning of the 32nd ATCM. In paragraph 3 of that document, the consultative parties pledged to, quote, reaffirm the importance they attach to the contribution made by the treaty and by Article 4 in particular to ensuring the continuance of international harmony in Antarctica. And again, I think that invites the suggestion that there should be no enlargement or extension of existing claims. Similarly, in paragraph 5 of the declaration, the consultative parties pledged to, quote, reaffirm their commitment to Article 7 of the Environmental Protocol, which prohibits any activity related to mineral resources other than scientific research. Again, one may infer that that should be applied to the continental shelf area and should suggest that there should be no drilling or exploration or prospecting activity on the continental shelves. Second challenge, which has come up here repeatedly and was initially mentioned by Ms. Kim, a student essay winner, and that is the challenge of biological prospecting or bioprospecting. There are a number of interesting legal questions that are invited by this notion of biological prospecting. As was mentioned earlier, there are at least 187 research organizations in 27 states that have already become involved in this activity on and around the continent. What are the questions pertaining to bioprospecting? Well, for one thing, there's no universal definition of what the term means. I think that's going to have to be a starting point in terms of coming to grips with this issue as a challenge to the treaty. Another concern is who has the authority to determine access to genetic resources in Antarctica. Do the climate states possess that authority? And if not, who does? Does sufficient sovereignty reside in those claims to give a climate state the necessary authority to make that decision? What happens if there's a major discovery with respect to a genetic resource that produces hundreds of million dollars in potential profits? Who should share in the distribution of those revenues? And will the climate states become perhaps more concerned about that than in the Antarctic Treaty itself? Some people have alleged that that was an important consideration in the defeat of Cramer. It may well have been. The point being is, does biological prospecting present the same sort of disruptive threat to the treaty system that the creation of a minerals regime did? Again, are the benefits to be retained solely by the company who invest in that project, or should they be shared amongst all the Antarctic consultative parties, or should they be distributed to an international authority? One point I should make here, and this was touched on by Professor Karras earlier today, I think the Cramer Agreement has a very important legacy and some very important provisions in it, which may well hold some clues to how you deal with biological prospecting. For one thing, in Chapter 3, you have a prospecting section in Cramer, which may well give clues on how you should deal with biological prospecting on the Antarctic continent. And again, I'm not going to get into the details of operators and all those, but the good work of Tucker Scully and Chris Beebe and John Heap should be maximized if it is relevant to dealing with this particular challenge to the Antarctic treaty system. And last but not least, there's the issue of Japanese whaling and the reaction by Australia that was first broached by Professor Gillian Triggs on the first day of this conference. The International Whaling Commission, as we all know, is primarily responsible for dealing with the issue of whaling, even within the area south of 60 degrees south latitude. But that's invited some problems, namely between Australia and Japan. Why so? Australia established a whale sanctuary in the Southern Ocean, offshore its Australian Antarctic Treaty. It also has exclusive economic zone claims over the waters. And much of the Japanese whaling was done in that particular vicinity. And that's what I think really sparked this whole issue to end up in court, in an Australian federal court. Again, to remind you, it was the Humane Society that brought this case against Kyoto, a Japanese whaling company. And as Professor Triggs noted, it was a very important decision for Australia, which did issue an injunction against the Japanese company, but there's never have, to the best of my knowledge, there's not been an active enforcement process applied against the Japanese whaling vessels. Now, finally, with respect to this whaling issue, the situation becomes more complicated simply because there have been other actors who become involved, and these two were alluded to by Professor Triggs, and that's the Shepherd Whaling Conservation Society, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. They have rammed may be too strong. They have hit Japanese whalers with their vessels. It's caused a lot of controversy and consternation. There have been accusations of whether or not this is an unsafe practice that threatens the safety of Japanese whalers. And one question that came to my mind is, might aggressive confrontations by these conservation groups or even with the Japanese having the possibility of responding, might these be considered a breach of the fiat that the Antarctic Treaty area should be used exclusively for peaceful purposes and not become the scene or object of international discord? Finally, with respect to these challenges, I think it's important to note that none of them are inevitable as threats to the treaty system. I think, to echo Judge Gallitzin, the key here is the calculus of national interest of the party states themselves. So long as the principal ATCP governments perceive that their own national interests are better served by remaining in common part of the treaty system and subjugating some of these more parochial interests to the common good of the treaty interest, then I think the Antarctic Treaty will be in good shape. But should the claimant states or Japan or other actors involved in biological prospecting choose to pursue their own narrow interests at the expense of the treaty system, then I think you could see these challenges rising to the level of real threats.
Thank you very much. I think you would agree that our participants here in the panel are giving you what I would call some drill-throughs across all of the issues that have been brought forward. And thank you, Chris, for that. Our next panelist is Ambassador Helena Odemark from Sweden. She is Ambassador for Arctic and Antarctic Affairs in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and a colleague that we've had the privilege of working with in both poles, in Antarctica and in the Arctic region. I like to tell a story about her. When she came to become this ambassador some years ago, she began a very serious effort to better understand how science fits into this, attended many of our meetings, and she's as articulate about the role science plays in Antarctica and Arctic as any diplomat I know. And it's a pleasure to welcome you here and to hear your insight from your years of experience in both poles. Welcome, Helena.
Thank you very much. And I come into this with a perspective, as you say, working in the Ministry for Foreign Affairs in a country that is a contracting party to the Antarctic Treaty, to CAMELAR, and to several of the other conventions that have been mentioned during the presentations. So that's a perspective that I have, which is a perspective that I don't think really has been so well represented in the various presentations over the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday up till now. And on that basis, I've tried to sort of think through what were the main impressions from these days and from all the very informative and very interesting presentations and the many discussions in the panels, the questions from the floor, the discussions that came about. And one thing struck me very much from the first 2 days and came through in many of the presentations and in the discussions, question and answer sessions, and that was the importance of the actual context of the time when something happens, when a political decision is taken by governments, because we're talking here about arrangements that are based on decisions taken by governments representing states. So there are political decisions to adopt a treaty. There are political decisions to start negotiations on something. There are political decisions that determine the progress we make on a specific issue that we are working on in one or the other intergovernmental forum. And the Antarctic Treaty was adopted in 1959. And it was very, very clear in the presentation that at that time, the Cold War was very prominent, and the nuclear arms race was very prominent, and the concerns about disarmament were very prominent in the key governments that were involved in those negotiations. It also came through very clearly that there was a parallel activity going on in the UN General Assembly with interests from many quarters coming up in that forum concerning Antarctica. So there was, in a way, two major processes that were political, that had much wider connotations, that seems to have very much influenced the fact that it was possible to agree in 1959 to adopt this particular treaty, the Antarctic Treaty. And those two sets of considerations, they are never ever referred to in the daily work in the ATCMs or in the CAMLR meetings today. We might know about them as being part of the history of how the how the treaty came about and the considerations around it, but it's not something that influences the work today. That was something that was prominent in the 50s. It influenced everything governments did in those days. But now it is not on the table. It's not totally forgotten, but it belongs to the past. And then afterwards, we had the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, with environmental concerns being extremely prominent and influencing also, it seems, very much the work inside the Antarctic Treaty system. Progress could be made on environmental issues in this forum because, and very much as part of the general interest in environmental issues that our governments had, and there was first a new interest and then a very important interest and then a more specific interest. But environmental issues came up and we could make lots of progress in the Antarctic Treaty system. Sustainable development was a term coined in those years as well, and it was developed and that came in. So it's probably fairly important for us to now and then consider what is the context today that we're operating in. The treaty is the same treaty, the same text as was adopted in 59. And the other conventions and the protocols and the annexes, the text is there. But how is it read? How is it interpreted? And what is it used for? Which issues do we use these treaties and these legal texts to address today? That is not necessarily determined only by what is happening in Antarctica. It's not necessarily determined primarily by what's happening in the scientific area. It's probably, to a large extent, determined by other factors, which are the prevailing political concerns that our governments are focused on today, that influence so much of what these governments do, what they give priority to, what they put resources in, what they put their political efforts on. And we can identify, I think, at least two major scenario descriptions. One is climate change, very high up on the political agenda for most governments. And the other is globalization, which is affecting most of the things that happen now in various ways and implicitly or explicitly being referred to. But that, I think, are two factors that do influence today more than the scientific results what issues we can make progress on at this point in time. And I think this came out very clearly, this fact that the historical context of the 50s influenced what happened then. The present context will influence what happens now. Which issues can we move on? Which issues can we not move on? Regardless of whether we have good science advice or not, there are other things that influence. So that's a first consideration that
very good.
I'm making from what I've heard these days. Then there's been a lot of talk about overlapping legal regimes and the conflicts that could arise and how they could be resolved depending on the situation, and there were examples, and you gave some examples again now. And I think that is, of course, correct. We had many informative presentations on the legal regimes that are in place and what they address, how they can be used. And I think what I take away from these presentations is most of all the fact that, yes, there are overlapping regimes, and there probably will be more overlapping regimes when we build up more, when we move forward on creating rules, regulations in the legal area. But if we have the political will to look for solutions and synergies, as was already said in one of the previous sessions, then we will be looking for solutions. We will be looking for synergies. If we don't have the political will to look for solutions and synergies, then the political will be directed towards looking for conflict. And it would be extremely easy for all of us to find lots of things to create a conflict around. So the legal regimes are there. They will expand and be developed. We already have overlaps. There will be more. But whether that is a problem or not depends on the political will. Do we want to move in the direction of looking for solutions? Then all the brain power available will be geared in that direction. But if not all of us do that, and some or many are looking for conflicts, it would be so easy to block progress on all the various issues that are on the table. And the arguments can be built up and we can, you know, go absolutely nowhere. So this is really a question of political will. Mm-hmm. Which direction do we go? We have the lawyers, we have the legal experts, and they will be able to do the work. But at least as far as governments are concerned, they do work in a political framework where the political leadership set the direction. Are we looking for solutions, cooperation, or are we looking for conflicts in order to prevent the process from going forward, prevent work from going forward on a specific issue? In that case, of course, lawyers can be extremely useful in putting up all sorts of questions. And they will be used for that purpose.
That's true.
Those that work for the governments and their arguments, if not them themselves, will be used in that way. So this, to me, is not a question of sort of a real difficulty. It's not neutral. It depends on whether we have political will towards a positive outcome or towards a negative outcome. Then a third consideration, and that's the final one at this stage at least, is more about the practical workings of the ATCM, or the Antarctic Treaty system, I should say. The Antarctic Treaty and CAMELAR primarily, where we've seen that we work on the basis of scientific advice, and we need scientific advice. And the system is built so that we shall work on the basis of scientific advice. And that scientific advice is important for the CAMELAR Commission. In that commission, we get it from the scientific committee. That scientific advice is also very important for the work in the Committee on Environmental Protection. And that committee needs to have scientific advice, but it doesn't really have a way of getting that properly established, it seems. We have SCAR, and SCAR gives input to the whole Antarctic Treaty system in various ways. But one could think in terms of the scientific advice that we build up and create inside the system. Where should it go in the first instance? And where should it be made use of in the first instance? And it seems to me that the scientific committee and SCAR need to provide input to the Kamilar Commission. It would also be very good if there was a mechanism to provide that kind of input, scientific advice, to CEP. Then CEP in turn provides advice to ATCM. But CEP should not be considered to be a scientific expert body. CEP is an expert body on environmental protection, which is wider than scientific advice. So they need to base their work on scientific advice. And the ATCM also has the operations committee. And in addition, we have COMNAP. And we have the International Maritime Organization. There seem to be possibilities, I think, there to maybe organize the work in such a way that we work in a more efficient manner. On tourism, we have the Tourism Committee under the ATCM. We have IATO, the operators. And again, we have the IMO as being important fora. That's another sort of grouping, which isn't today really a grouping. But when I'm listening to all the interventions and all the presentations, they come out as two separate groupings in my head. And then we have the final committee in the ATCM, which is financial legal. And that is probably a fairly strange combination to put the financial issues and the legal issues in one and the same committee. It's been explained to me sort of for how that came about, and I can accept that, of course. But looking to the future, it would probably be much better to have a budget committee operating with the budget and the administrative issues that we need to deal with in relation to the secretariat, etc., and to separate out the real proper legal issues and deal with them in a way that is disconnected from the financial and budgetary matters. And then going on to what also Jan Huber was talking about the other day, the intersessional work. That the more intersessional work we can do, the more we will probably be able to achieve during those 2 weeks a year when we actually do meet. 2 weeks is not a long time. And if we have prepared issues through some intersessional work, we're much more likely to make progress during the ATCM meetings than we are if we have not done any intersessional work. So there's probably scope for lots of improvement in that respect and in the way we actually organize the work. And going back to what I said about the scientific input, I think it could be interesting to consider at some stage in the ATCM context whether we can think of a more effective way of scheduling the meetings during a calendar year in order to have the scientific input provided to the bodies that need to have scientific input and get the meetings to happen in the right order.
Thank you very much. I can agree that she's bringing a new perspective to many of our conversations. Thank you very much. How does one introduce Jan Tude, who has been a powerful force in the scientific community in both poles? As many of you know, he was the director of the Alfred Wegener Institute for Polar and Marine Research, been on the faculty of several institutions. Background is in geology and paleontology, brings that scientific perspective. But what I consider his role is the major leader in the whole European arena to bring many of us from other countries together to work both in the polar regions of the Arctic and the polar regions of Antarctica. And it's a pleasure to introduce you and ask you to share your thoughts as well.
Thanks very much. First of all, thanks for the invitation to come to Washington and to participate in this meeting. I think this was very exciting. And I'm looking forward to the book and all the written documents which are coming out of this. I want to call my intervention Times of Change. And my conclusion is that the future is bright for science under the framework of the Antarctic Treaty. And I'm basing this on the Forever Declaration, which highlights research and science and SCAR and so on. And so I would like to extend my gratitude that this has been done, because this would not have been possible 10 years ago, I think. Now, let me make 3 points. I will start off a little bit with my own experience. I got into polar research via the Arctic. ONR organized a planning conference for the Arctic Ocean in 1979 in Copenhagen, and this was in preparation for the Swedish Umeå expedition. And at that time, the Umeå was supposed to celebrate the 100th anniversary of Nordenskjöld's expedition along northern Siberia. But the Soviet Navy naturally said, no way. Swedes, too far, too dangerous. So they went. So the Umeå had to go into the deep waters to the north of, and west of Svalbard, and demonstrated for the first time that you can use these heavy-duty icebreakers very successfully in the Arctic. And the possibility, well, or the perspective was also for the Antarctic, naturally. And so this was then later followed up with the first deeper penetration of Polarstern to the Gackle Ridge in 1987. And in 1991, the Swedish Odin and Polarstern as the first conventionally driven vessels reached the North Pole. So this was the northern introduction. I think this is already reflecting substantial change. Now, the only thing which we really missed in 1982, 1983, we could have celebrated the 100th anniversary of the first polar, international polar year. And none of the polar scientists thought about it. And it still escapes my understanding how you can let such a golden opportunity slip by. Now then, in the 90s, I started to get in touch with the AVI and with the Antarctic Treaty System and with SCAR. And my first visit my first attendance of the SCAR meeting in Concepcion confronted me and I'm overdrawing a little bit, with a club of very senior persons, which some of them were not even scientists, and they obviously knew each other very well, but there was nothing really exciting going on. And as David Walton said, Chris Repley and I, we got pretty upset and said this does not fit the end of the last century, really. And briefly afterwards, I visited my first Antarctic Treaty meeting, and I was pretty ignorant until I came there, and then we had first the plenary, okay, the national delegations. I couldn't see many Antarctic scientists, really, in the entire groupings. And in the afternoon, they split up into the two committees, and I went to the CEP. And I could see there was nobody with any real scientific insight sitting around the table. But SCAR, the SCAR representative, and some other organizations were pushed into the back of the room and accept a short report on the activities of SCAR science, and SCAR didn't play a major role in the entire agenda. And so SCAR was really sidelined, and we came pretty soon, pretty quickly to the conclusion something has to change, or ADCM is going to turn to other organizations to get their advice. And so we have to do something about this. And so there was a review of SCAR, of its structure and of its composition and so on. And we had to find some ways to make SCAR so attractive to the Antarctic Treaty System that we would be accepted as the major source of scientific advice. And this was, I think everybody agreed about that. So first of all, we introduced a rule that the delegates to SCAR had to be bona fide scientists. And so this was a major obstacle already but we succeeded to fight that through. Then SCAR decided that they really wanted to strive after excellence in Antarctic and Southern Ocean science. We are aware that SCAR does not have a monopoly, but in close collaboration with other relevant international science organization, it has to address major Antarctic topics and Southern Ocean topics, and we have sought this partnership, and I think we have succeeded to develop an image of scientific excellence. Now, SCAR was also expected to provide scientific leadership, And this required focus. This lacked completely. And so we had an early discussion on that. The entire scientific profile of SCAR was supposed to be built around five major strategic scientific programs, which would reorganize the many-fold activities of the many working groups and different bodies under the umbrella of SCAR. And on the other hand, you have to realize that no organization can do everything that they want. So this focus was really important, and I think we succeeded to do so. These five strategic programs are running out in 2 or 3 years, and that's why Chuck Kennicott, the president of SCAR, was able to provide you with such a long list of exciting scientific themes when he made his presentation here yesterday. Now you have to make sure that the themes or the strategic perspectives you take up cover frontier research. And I think Chuck Kennicott mentioned a number of the areas where frontier research really can be done. The subglacial lake activities, for example, would count. Then the geology of the subglacial crust and so on. So I think SCAR is succeeding in doing that. Now, David Warden also highlighted the fact that SCAR needs to provide independent, high-quality scientific advice, and either in responses to questions from the ADCM or based on own initiatives. And this has really been thought about, and I think this is very, very important that nobody really puts pressure on SCAR to come up with political opinions. At the same time, SCAR has to look at the mode and ethics of the conduct of Antarctic science. And I think SCAR has developed a small paper about this, and so this is an important aspect of our work. Now then, as an academic or a science-oriented organization, you can pick up many themes which are in reality irrelevant to a political body like the Antarctic Treaty System. And so SCAR has also to strive to take up some relevant themes or opinions to make sure that it obtains its position as the major scientific advisor to, in this case, the Antarctic Treaty System. And I think we have succeeded to do so. 2 days ago at the press conference in London, a comprehensive volume on the impact of climate change on the Antarctic has been distributed, and I think it has gotten a wide press coverage, and Chuck Kennicott has actually brought a number of volumes here. So I think the future is bright. There's a lot of political attention at the heads of the state. They are providing substantial money. We have very modern infrastructure. And a particular aspect of our work is that we have opened up the scientific meetings or considerations of SCAR. Previously, this was a closed shop and closed meetings. Since 2004, we organized an open science meeting, and we are suddenly attracting somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 mostly young polar scientists, highly motivated people. And I think only this mode of our change in operation really allowed us to conduct a successful IPY, because we suddenly could draw on a large family of young and excellent scientists. Now, there are naturally dangers. One is, I think there's a gray zone between the Antarctic Treaty System, CEP, and SCAR. I mean, I was almost a little bit shocked when Olaf Oram said that CEP is providing scientific advice to SCAR. Maybe I misunderstood him, but I think this is a dangerous thing. We do not want to monopolize it, but I think we want to give the best quality scientific advice to the Antarctic Treaty System, and we also want to be the body who's asked by the Antarctic Treaty System for this advice. Now, there are problems. The scientific scene and organization is quite fragmented. On the Northern Hemisphere, you have IASC and AOSB and the regional boards, and there's quite a bit of disorder after an attempt to restructure this. And I see also that a similar situation exists on the Southern Hemisphere, with SCAR covering a certain series of topics. Then there's CAMELAR, there are other scientific bodies who are operating in the Southern Ocean on Antarctica. And so somehow the scientific community has to find together. And we have been debating, not very, very successfully, but we have been debating how we could link this scientific community from the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere. And maybe one idea which could be entertained is that the two groupings are maintained, but as an umbrella, an international union of polar sciences could be funded to give the entire topic of polar research and polar sciences a much better and publicly visible profile. Then I've been always disturbed by the separation between logistics and science. On the Southern Hemisphere, this is Skar and Komnap. On the Northern Hemisphere, this is Ayask and Faro. Because the situation is so, first of all, these are very closely linked and almost interdependent. And sometimes new technology drives science, sometimes science drives new technology. And I feel, and I naturally know in the case of Komnap, this is historic reasons, and some personalities which were the reason for this separation, I think they should be very, very close together. And for me, it's almost a foreign thought that these are formally separated. This has an impact on the use of our infrastructure. I don't think we use the stations on the Southern Hemisphere in Antarctica very efficient. Some of the stations have capacities which are not used by the individual nations. And I think there has to come, as proposed by the European Polar Board, a scheme how to you can exchange international places on these stations. Then the ships are not used, and there are only very few dedicated polar research vessels available. The mode of operation is really inefficient. They go forth and back between the southern and northern hemisphere. Some of them are misused to logistic purposes, while you could send a garbage boat to collect all the containers with garbage and so on around Antarctica. So I think there's a lot of work to be done for Komnap and Faro, and we have to really to look at the mode of operation and on the possibilities which we could develop if much of the ship time, of the value of research ship time on our research vessels is freed. But anyway, my conclusion is that our future in science is bright. It's bright under the auspices of the Antarctic Treaty System. So thanks. Right,
beautiful. Thank you very much. We have, I think, maybe a time for one or two comments. We have some wrap-up to do here, and we're designed to try to be done between 4:45 and shortly thereafter. But if someone has a burning comment that they'd like to add, because the richness of experience in this room is really wide and deep, so if there's a comment, we'd welcome it. Do I see? There's a hand way back. If someone could take the mic far, yes. Right hand, my right hand.
His Excellency, the Chilean ambassador.
And the Chilean ambassador here. Why don't we start with our ambassador first, and then we'll go to the upper right-hand corner, or to your left.
Thank you very much, Bob. I would like to just supplement some of the material, the rich material the panel has given us, and I expect that will be fed up into the Antarctic system. I would say with regard to what Jim Barnes produced, that is an action plan, and I would say Chile supports all the components. When we come out to the practical elements, maybe we may have some discrepancies, but all the important subjects that have some urgency have been put there. With regard to what was said by Chris Joyner, certainly they are elements that are upsetting, but they must be put into perspective. It is good to remember that at least among the overlapping claimants on the peninsula, the claims to the continental shelf were made in 1946 by Argentina, in 1947 by Chile, in 1950 by the UK. So they came into the system, into the Article 4, with their maritime claims. The reflections by Ambassador Otmark, I think, are very useful if one wants to put a bit some order into the growth of the system. And of course, Professor Tiede has added to that the fact that it is essential that logistics and science, or science uppermost, works closely with logistics. But we are going that direction. There was a very good workshop between Camelar and CEP. Why not among the other components? I read your message that way, and it is for us all to move it in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Your experience is long and historic and been very helpful to all of us. I think there is time for one comment in the far back. Is the mic there, please?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please. Okay.
I was particularly struck by Ambassador Odmark's comments on the context of our times. And it seems to me the context of our times now, and at least for the next 50 years into the future, is going to be climate change. And I've been struck throughout all the discussions throughout the week on the claimant nations. We're claiming the rocks. We're claiming the minerals beneath the surface. We're claiming the fish. We're claiming virtually everything but the atmospheric gases that we're emitting or moving over the polar regions. And the soot in the atmosphere. The polar environments are literally melting before our very eyes. And yet, this doesn't seem to be on the radar screen. And I'm thinking back. I worked with the National Science Foundation 20 years ago, and when they were, you know, first getting really serious about environmental protection and removing everything, even the bodily fluids and solids that were emitted on a personal basis. And yet the carbon is still belching out of the stations. There's no control over the carbon footprint. And I'm just wondering if one thing that could be done to celebrate this very important anniversary would be to try to take some action, at least for the polar regions, to draw attention to a policy of, you know, pack it in, pack it out. If you're burning carbon, don't emit the carbon dioxide. Keep the greenhouse gases to a minimum, because that does seem... there's not going to be much to protect in the polar regions without the ice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to ask you to join me in... One more, I see. Okay. I have to watch the time I'm being given the T word, so make, if you could, short.
I'll be short, Bob. I just took the... Since I was sitting close to her, I thought I'd take the opportunity to say... I think this meeting has been excellent in some ways. It's brought out new thoughts for many of us, historical observations. The title of the meeting is 50 Years Science Policy Interaction, slightly longer, but that's the main point. Perhaps we've suffered a little bit, and I'm glad that Helena brought this up, that there have been more lawyers than policymakers among the speakers, and more other kinds of speakers like myself. In other words, we haven't really had the policy part so well, and I think that's going to be a challenge for the future, because as Helena said, if there's a political will, the solutions can be found to most of these questions. I want to especially laud Jim Barnes for having done the work in pulling out some of the positions and ideas sitting around in the community. I think there's a lot of stuff here to be worked at in the future. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more discussion on how we can do this in the best possible way. But there were not those people here to discuss that. And so I think that's a challenge for the next years. And then I'll just pick up what you said. There are some other large looming issues which are above and beyond Antarctica. And if they're not solved elsewhere, we cannot solve them through the Antarctic Treaty. Now, bioprospecting is a good example that Joyner spoke about. It will not be solved, and I'll go to my close, Bob, but it will not be solved in the Antarctic scene unless one can decide how to define biological prospecting, etc., etc. Some things cannot be solved by the Antarctic community. But we can solve those particular challenging issues there if we have the goodwill. And so far, nothing has indicated that that will not permeate into the next 50 years.
Thank you, Olaf. I would like to ask you all to join me in thanking our four panelists for very insightful comments. And Olaf, you sort of set the stage that says there are things to do, many of which were brought forward here and throughout the 3 days. And so the various mechanisms in the Antarctic Treaty, as well as the various communities of lawyers and scientists and political scientists and politicians and people from our ministries working together, I think we have our agenda set for us. And thank you for coming, and thank our panelists for their work.
So, Bob, I have a last task for you. The next to your chair are some medals on the floor. If I could ask you to present them on behalf of the International Board to Jim Barnes. There's a name on the bottom of them, each of them. So between Chris, Jim, Helena, and Jorn, if you could take a look at the bottom and make sure that you receive the right medal. Okay, good. And Bob, I also have one for you on behalf of the International Board.